So over the last 4 years of doing consulting and culture coaching, I have done over 100 surveys of college, high school, and club teams to assess their culture. And when I send out these surveys, the number one complaint or issue that players and even parents mention is playing time. But it's not just playing time. You know, typically people articulate their complaint with a little bit more detail. Now these complaints, though, they can all be summed up in their language really into four main issues or categories. First, people do not understand how decisions are made around playing time. The second one is they perceive a misalignment in values. What that means is coaches say they value hard work, but they don't actually play the players that work the hardest from their perspective. Now, the third big reason is the fear of the unknown. Players never know if they're going to play or not, and that uncertainty drives them crazy. And the last one, the fourth one, is unmet expectations. They think their role or minutes will be more than it is going into a season or a game, oftentimes because of something the coach said, and then they're let down. Now, these are really just surface issues, though. And before we can address these issues and these complaints, we need to really understand what is at the core of these complaints, why these things bother people so much. And so today, Nate and I are going to take a step back and really discuss why it's so hard for us to communicate and why it's so hard for our players and their parents to understand and accept our decisions. Welcome to the Coaching Culture Podcast, brought to you by Thrive on Challenge. I'm JP Nurbin, joined by my friend and co-host Nate Sanderson. Each week in about 30 minutes, we discuss important principles and strategies of transformational leadership. At Thrive on Challenge, we help coaches to raise the standards and strengthen the relationships in their program because we know this type of culture produces better leaders, better people, and better results. To learn more about how we can help you, go to thriveonchallenge.com, where you can also subscribe to our weekly newsletter and get the coaching notes to every episode of this podcast.
Well, JP, some of the things you described in the prologue today, I'm sure come as no surprise to the coaches in our audience. And in fact, I would venture to guess that everybody listening here this week has encountered playing time issues, conflicts, misunderstandings between parents and them and the coaches, or players and the coaches. And quite frankly, I don't care who's doing the survey, we're going to find typically that playing time is the number one cause of most arguments and disagreements and misunderstandings when it comes to coaching these days. Now, what we want to explore here in our conversation today is not necessarily just giving away some practical ideas of how to address and try to minimize these issues for coaches, but really to take a deeper dive into understanding why is playing time such a difficult topic of conversation? In other words, it's uncomfortable. And I think many of us, JP, as coaches, we kind of long for that mythical day gone by when the head coach was the authority figure, when they made a decision about the starting lineup, they made a decision about a substitution or a rotation. It was the law, and players didn't question their coaches, parents didn't question their coaches. And there was sort of an air of authority here that, for whatever reason, doesn't seem to exist in the same way today, not certainly just for coaches, but for teachers and many others in our society. And I don't think we really take the time to think about what are some of the obstacles that are in our path when it comes to having a productive conversation about playing time. Rather than just saying parents are different or kids are different, society's different, I think there's some really specific things that have affected the perspective of players and parents and coaches over the years that make it really difficult to find common ground when it comes to talking about playing time. And we're going to unpack some of those here today. And I listened to Adam Bradley and TJ Rosine talk on the Hardwood Hustle about a year ago. And Adam had asked TJ, who is a Division II coach at Emmanuel College down in Georgia, if he ever talks to parents about playing time. And TJ had such an interesting answer. He said, you know, Adam, I don't have anything against parents. It's not that I don't want to have these conversations. It's just that I don't know how we can sit down in a 15 or 30 minute meeting and I can explain to that family or explain to that parent everything that I've learned about basketball and that has brought me to the place that we are today, that has informed the way that I make decisions, I've got 30 years in the game, 12 years, 14 years as a player, 20 years as a coach. How do I boil all of that down into a conversation to help a parent understand how I think about playing time decisions? And when he said that, that made a lot of sense to me, but that also made me think about the people sitting on the other side of the table in that meeting. Mom and dad have a history with that child in athletics, in that specific sport. They were probably the first one that took him out to the driveway, showed him how to hold or pass or shoot a basketball, how to kick a soccer ball, how to throw a football. They've been at every youth event, every game, every tournament. They've probably coached them at the youth levels and maybe beyond. And so here they have, in a sense, a 10-year scouting report on their child as a player. How are they supposed to communicate and get you, the coach, or me, the coach, to understand their perspective and everything that's led to this moment or them being on your team in a 15 or 30 minute meeting? There's so much experience with so little overlap, it naturally creates a barrier to understanding.
Well, Nate, I think another aspect of that is the player's experience. And I think it's very hard for us as coaches to understand that player's experience. I mean, they've been coming up through the youth ranks, they've gone to camps, they've gotten a lot of affirmation before they got to you. And that affirmation comes from largely a culture that tells kids they're great and to chase their dreams and you're going to be great, you know, and they're paying these fees to go to these kicking camps or different things like that. They're getting a lot of affirmation. And honestly, they're probably one of the better players on their team. But as they continue to progress and move up, that becomes less so the case. So it's just a vastly different experience. I'd also just make a side note that I think it's challenging for us as coaches to really understand and empathize with our players in these situations, is that so often the coach's experience as a player was one that they were one of the better players. You know, it's just a natural occurrence. Not all coaches, but just more coaches than not were the better players on their team. You know, they were passionate about their sport, and that naturally trickles them into coaching. But there's so many of our players that don't have that experience. They're the end of the bench. And so it's just very challenging for coaches to be able to always, you know, come to that mutual understanding or empathize with the player's experience because we haven't been through it before.
Now, another thing that makes it difficult to communicate about playing time is that the coach's identity and the player or the parent's identity, what's at the center of how they define themselves in the sport, is often different. The coach obviously is responsible for the program and responsible for the team. And you hear this all the time. You know, Bill Belichick always says, I make the decisions that are best for the team, TEAM, right? As though that justifies everything that they do, from roster cuts to playing time to starters to scheme to whatever. It's always about what is best for the team. And in fact, his definition of mental toughness is doing what's best for the team, even when it's not what's best for you. And I think that on the one hand, we like to celebrate that. On the other hand, you also have to acknowledge that the center of the identity map, or the parent or the player's identity, is their own journey, right? Like, it's hard in our society today to sacrifice what I want as an individual for the good of the team. That the parent is going to be more loyal to their child at the end of the day than they are to a team of strangers or their children's peers on this team. And I think one thing that's interesting about this, I just finished reading Nick Nurse's book, and he talks about, before he got into the NBA, one of the things that he learned was that players are going to have their own individual agendas. They want the next contract, they want playing time, they want stats, they want to hang on in the league, whatever it might be. And he said, rather than telling them, no, you got to sacrifice those things for the good of the team, he said, my challenge was always trying to find a way to leverage those individual interests in a way that can still serve the team. And really talked about a negotiation almost between a player's roles and their desires and what the team could offer them if they were to work that into the fold, if that makes sense. But ultimately, we tend to celebrate coaches that say it's always about the team. And we celebrate parents that say, I'll do whatever I need to do to help my child be successful in life. And yet when it comes to playing time, those two motivations are often naturally at odds with each other.
Well, I think one of the things that you're pointing out, Nate, is that there's kind of two different arguments being made. As the coach, we're making an argument for why this player should play or shouldn't play in the interest of the team. And it's a completely different argument that a player or their parent would be making for them about why they should play, because it's about what's in their best interest. And so it's really, really challenging to come to an agreement when you're not even arguing the same thing.
Well, and JP, to be fair to the player, they are out for the sport typically because they love the sport. And now we're asking them to play a subservient role potentially as a reserve or as a energy guy off the bench or in practice, effectively asking them to be out but not to play the sport that they love. Imagine how difficult that can be for that player, not only to deal with, but to be able to articulate in a conversation about playing time. Incredibly tough. Now, another thing that makes this difficult is that, and this is building off of kind of that different history that coaches and parents and players have with that player, is that up until the high school level, oftentimes parents were able to see all of the things that happen in a child's athletic journey. What I mean by that is, if the coach in third grade or fifth grade or seventh grade says, we're going to play the best players that have the best attitudes, oftentimes the parents can sit in on practice and they can watch and they can see who are the best players and who has the best attitudes. And oftentimes they're at all the games, and at the lower levels, everybody's playing, maybe not equally, but they get a chance to see how their son or daughter compares to everybody else that gets a chance to play. And so that information that feeds into evaluation is accessible to parents. But when they get to high school and we have closed practices and their player, their daughter, their son is, let's say, number 10, 11, 12, they're a reserve, they're not in the rotation, not only does the parent not get to see them in practice, but they don't get to see them compete on a Tuesday or Friday night in a basketball season either if they're not in the rotation. And now imagine them trying to understand why their player or why their son or daughter isn't playing. They see what's out on the floor. They think, well, my kid's better than number 6, 7, or 8. I just don't understand why he's not playing. But they don't ever get to see them in competition with those players, which again means that the coaches have access to different information than the parents do when it comes down to trying to communicate about differences over playing time.
Yeah, and one of the ways that we have found coaches can help to share some of that perspective with parents around playing time, that even Anson Torrance does at North Carolina, is the competitive cauldron, which is data and practice around people competing. And Torrance has been known to share it with some of his parents via email. This is a Division I program and one of the top programs in the country. I think even players struggle with that perspective. They come in from practice and they're not seeing things from the coach's lens. And oftentimes that can become twisted from the player's perspective. They think they're playing well in practice, and it becomes very hard for them to really objectively observe. Not that we're perfect as coaches when it comes to objective observations and practices, but we're more so. They're obviously influenced by a lot of factors as well. And so I think the mutual perspectives, you know, these two various perspectives, it's an issue for coach and parent. It's also an issue for coach and player.
You and I have had enough conversations off air about objective data and some of the things that we've been trying to measure, even with your team, to try to not only evaluate players and better understand their strengths and weaknesses, what they bring to the team and potentially how they hurt the team, but how to be able to better communicate that to players to help them to be able to improve. And one of the things that objective data does for you is it creates an opportunity to discuss something in common. In other words, a player may have a history playing club sports or AAU sports or with an individual trainer, but A, the coach of the high school team doesn't necessarily see those games to understand that history. And B, that time is not spent in context with the players that they are competing with now at the high school level for playing time. One of the other challenges about talking about playing time and really getting players and parents to understand the dilemma we feel as coaches is that playing time is a limited resource. In other words, at the high school level in the state of Iowa, I get to start in a basketball game 5 players. We play 32 minutes of basketball in a game. I get 160 minutes to distribute to the players on my team. That doesn't matter how many players I'm dressing. We might dress 8 players or we might dress 18 players. I still have a limited number of starters and a limited number of minutes. Now, this seems like common sense, but I want you to contrast that just for a moment with what a player experiences in the classroom. They walk into a class of 20 students, let's say, and on the first day of class, they get a syllabus, and the syllabus says, in order to get an A in this class, you have to do well on these four papers and these four tests. And it's all laid out in terms of what is expected to get an A. Now, it's possible over the course of that semester that at the end, 20 students, every student in that room, could meet the criteria. They could do well on all four papers and all four tests and all walk out of the room with A's. Because when it comes to their classroom experience, there's an unlimited amount of A's that a teacher can give out. In sports, we don't have that luxury. And the thing that makes that even more difficult is not only is there a limited number of A's, let's say starting positions, but that those are given out essentially based on grading on a curve. In other words, it's not just you meet this 90% requirement to get an A, you have to be one of the top five students in the class or players on the team to get that starting role. And we don't grade that way in the classroom very often anymore. And so it's just a totally kind of different way to think about how something is earned that players as students don't really experience necessarily in a lot of other areas of their life.
You know, the funny thing is, I've never heard a coach or heard of a coach who said they didn't value hard work. We all talk about this to our players. We talk about it to our players' parents. Like every coach out there says, oh, we value hard work. And this grading scale thing you're talking about here, this issue, is why one of the biggest complaints from players and from parents comes down to this perceived misalignment in values. Like, oh, the coach says he values hard work, but he's not playing my kid because my kid works harder than the next kid, right? And so this is at the core of that very frustration they're experiencing. Because while we may value hard work, at the end of the day, for most of us, we choose to play people based upon performance and their ability, their talent in so many cases. So this is, you know, right, what you're saying here is such a big reason and underlying cause of that frustration that players and parents experience when it comes to playing time.
Now, when we talk about playing time being graded on a curve, here's another thing that is part of that equation. It matters who's in the gym. In other words, you might be an all-star player on a B-level team and be a starter, and then the next year transfer to the defending state champions, and all of a sudden, because you're in the gym with better players, your grade on a curve is going to be different because you have players that are going to be better than you. And so rather than being a starter, maybe you become somebody off the bench or into a reserve role. It's not that JP Nurbin all of a sudden became a terrible player. It's just the fact that there are different people in the room that you're competing with. And I think that sometimes as coaches, we feed into a myth out there that we tell our players that players control their playing time. You want to play more? It's totally under your control. And to an extent, that's true if the player is able to perform better than the players that are in front of them. But when it comes down to that equation about who plays and who doesn't, if I have 14 players on my varsity roster, that individual player is only 1/14 of the equation. Do the other 13 players matter when it comes to their evaluation comparatively? Absolutely, they do. But we don't often acknowledge that to players, because ultimately, if I have a player number 9 that wants to be number 8, and I say to number 9, you got to keep working hard, you got to get better at defense, and you got to stop turning the ball over, and they start to get better, but I'm also having a conversation with number 8, and I'm telling them what they need to do to get better and to stop hurting the team so they can keep improving. And if they're marginally better than number 9 gets better and 8 gets better, the gap doesn't change. And ultimately, like, you need that level of competition to improve your team, but it can be deflating if number 9 comes back to you a month later and says, Coach, I did everything you asked and I'm still not playing. I don't understand. Well, they don't understand because we didn't acknowledge that they're only 1/14 of the equation.
And I think coaches struggle with that because it's kind of taboo or really hard to say to a player that's trying to crack the starting lineup, well, you can do all these things, you work hard, but you're still not going to probably be better than the player in front of you if they keep working hard too. Like, I don't know if I've ever said that to a player until this season with my own team. It's like I had that realization of like this conversation around the players saying, what do I need to do to become a starter or move up in the lineup is, well, there's this is what you can do, but you have to understand that these players are better than you. They're more talented than you and by a significant amount. And so it's a lot of it's not within your control if you can crack into that starting lineup or move up into those spots. And that sounds brutal and that sounds harsh, but I think we avoid that so often. And then we create these expectations in these players' minds that only sets them up for disappointment because we were afraid to maybe speak the real truth to them.
And one of the simple ways, JP, that we try to communicate this with our team is just, you know, imagine for a moment that LeBron James's son, Bronny, who I think is 16 or 17 years old now, you know, playing on the elite level AAU and hoping to play with his dad on the Lakers someday, right? Imagine that instead of him being born and playing in Los Angeles, that he's playing in Springville, Iowa. Do you think that's going to change the playing time for the guys that are currently on the team in Springville, Iowa? Absolutely it is. And it's not just because of who his dad is. It's because he's a great player. So it matters who's in the gym. And when you take an example like that, it becomes a little bit more common sense maybe. Now, there's one more thing that we want to talk about here before we give you some other practical solutions on the way out the door here. And that is, there is a belief that if you were successful at the previous level, you're going to be guaranteed of being successful at the next level. And certainly there's some validity to that. If you're one of the better players in eighth grade, you're probably going to be one of the better players in ninth grade. But I think sometimes players and parents fail to understand that in the context of the game, when you go up a level, when you go from middle school basketball to trying to compete at the varsity level in high school, you're not just going against players that are your own age, but you're competing against juniors and seniors. Some of them have mustaches and big muscles because they've been lifting for, you know, 2, 3, 4 years longer than you have. And all of a sudden, that leap in competitiveness is difficult for them to sustain. And certainly that's the same from going from high school to the college level. And we don't always recognize that to use a classroom example, algebra and calculus are not the same. You know, in the same way that playing in high school is not the same as playing in college. And yet we don't always acknowledge that the higher that you progress, the more difficult it is to compete at that level.
Well, Nate, this issue of playing time, it's pretty complex. And thus, I really, truly believe we need to have a systematic approach to addressing playing time. Now, kind of organically over the last 4 years, working with coaches on their team's culture, me and you, we've put together a whole bunch of strategies, tools for coaches, and activities to do with their team to really address this issue. It's only really in the last year that I think I've started to really piece these together and how they can best be applied kind of in a systematic way. And so I really break it down for coaches, the systematic approach to playing time in three different phases. The first phase is determining playing time. Like, we need clarity within ourselves, first off, and then within our staff and within our team, how we determine playing time. And I don't think a lot of coaches can answer that question clearly if they ask themselves the question, how do you determine playing time? Much less explain it in a way that makes sense to their team. So the second phase is about communicating playing time decisions and roles to players in a way that is respectful but truthful. And we do way too much sugarcoating as coaches. And we need to communicate playing time at the start of the season and continuously throughout the season as roles and minutes do change. And the third and final phase really comes down to how we support players in their roles. We want every player not only to accept their role, heck, even embrace their role. We want them, though, to have a positive experience and to feel cared about regardless of their role. And so we have to be intentional in that process. Now, I'm sure this seems like a lot, like way too much for any coach to handle, which is why I put together another CoachTube course that really simplifies this system for coaches out there who really want to address this issue. And then the course includes activities to do with your team. It trains you up in a lot of the strategies we use with coaches and the Thrive on Challenge mentorship program. And also the course provides coaches with a lot of tools to make this simple throughout the season and not time consuming. Actually, will save you time.
JP, when you talk about determining, communicating, and supporting our playing time decisions, you know, I often compare that to what we experience in the classroom as teachers. And I've been out of full-time teaching for about 5 years now, but I do think back to the difference when I started in 2002 to when I finished my career here in 2015. When I started, the little red book in the top right-hand drawer of the teacher's desk that kept all the students' grades and a column of assignments on one side and across the top was the name of the students, and we just kept track of our assignments and their grades there, students never really knew exactly where they stood. And there were often times where they would ask after class, what's my grade? Or we'd have to post it on the end of their test so that they would know where they were at. And over the course of time, our communication as teachers has improved significantly. By the end of my career, we were giving out a syllabus that explained all the assignments or the major assignments and tests that they would experience during the term. We gave out rubrics for individual assignments so that they knew this is what constitutes an A or a B or meeting a standard or exceeding a standard. And think about this when it comes to knowing where they're at in the classroom. The advent of PowerSchool and other online grading platforms has allowed students and parents to know exactly where they're at, exactly how they did on a particular assignment at a moment's notice at any time. Now, I don't know that we're ever going to get to that level of communication as coaches compared to what we do in the classroom. But if you think again about comparing the effort that goes into making sure that students know what is expected, know how things are going to be graded, and are able to know exactly where they stand at any time, we very rarely meet those standards as coaches. And I think that provides maybe a template for the direction that we need to start going in order to improve our communication with players.
So coaches, my course, The Playing Time Culture System, it's now available at coachtube.com. You can save 25% this week only with the code COACHINGCULTURE. After this week, you can still save 10% with that code. I guarantee you the system will be simple to execute after taking the course, and the playing time issues in your team's culture, they will be diminished or significantly reduced. There is a link to the course and the details of this episode, as well as on the ThriveOnChallenge.com homepage.